This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy Pickett. The White House says that it is putting finishing touches on proposals to reform the police following George Floyd's killing while in police custody, but it also warned that it had concerns about the immunity for police officers being a non-starter or reducing that immunity. The White House press secretary says administration plans to address protester concerns about police brutality were reaching final edits and that they hope that it could be made public in the coming days. The U.S. state of New York is about to open up police discipline records. Governor Andrew Cuomo says he will sign into a law a measure that will no longer allow protection of files that had been kept secret under a controversial section of the state's civil rights law. It made law enforcement personnel records exempt from the state's Freedom of Information law. It said that George Floyd's brother has testified. He testified before the House Judiciary Committee asking them to stop police brutality. He is the brother of George Floyd, the African-American man who died in police custody 2 weeks ago and whose death has sparked national and worldwide protests urging racial equality and police reform. U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi called Wednesday for removal of 11 Confederate statues from the U.S. Capitol, part of a nationwide push to dismantle such memorials after George Floyd's death sparked mass anti-racism protests. Meanwhile, U.S. President Donald Trump says there will be not any renaming of military bases that currently honor leaders of the Confederacy. He said and tweeted on Wednesday that heroes trained at and deployed from what he called hallowed grounds, adding his administration would not consider renaming the magnificent and fabled military installations. This is VOA News. The coronavirus pandemic advanced steadily Wednesday through Latin America, where the death toll passed the milestone of 70,000 fatalities, even as Europe planned to reopen its external borders to foreigners in July. North and South America remained the epicenter of the global health crisis, accounting for almost half of the more than 415,000 deaths and 7.3 million infections worldwide. Brazil accounts for more than half of Latin America's total deaths. This even as the economic capital, Sao Paulo, began reopening shops Wednesday as part of a gradual resumption of activity. Shopping malls were set to reopen in a slew of cities Thursday, the day before Brazilians celebrate their Valentine's Day. 50 relatives of virus victims have filed complaints over the handling of the pandemic and the first such legal group action in Italy. They were filed at the prosecutor's office. The city in northern Italy was hit by the pandemic because it has become the symbol of the tragedy, according to Stefano Fusca, who created the group on Facebook. A leading global economy group said Wednesday that the COVID-19 pandemic has triggered the worst global recession in nearly a century, and things could get worse before they start to get better. The Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, also known as OECD, Secretary General Angel Aguirre painted a grim picture for the world, calling it the most severe global health, economic, and social crisis anyone alive today has ever seen. Comments came at a news briefing in Paris. In addition, the OECD says that the global economy will decline by at least 6% this year. If there's a second wave of COVID-19, they say it will be far worse. It could shrink as much as 7.6%. Disneyland and the U.S. state of California announced plans Wednesday to reopen next month, but at significantly limited capacity with no opportunities to hug Mickey Mouse or high-five Donald Duck for the time being. The plans still require government approval. The resort near Los Angeles would be welcome visitors back beginning July 17th. Disneyland is the world's second most visited theme park. Peru said Wednesday its exports of ginger almost tripled during the coronavirus pandemic. The spice is seen as a natural immune system booster. Most of the exports went to Spain, the Netherlands, and the United States. Spanish imports of Peruvian ginger increased more than 500%. More at VOAnews.com. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, June 11th. And here are some of the stories we are covering, reflecting on the somewhat mixed legacy of the late Burundian President Pierre Nkurunziza.
When it comes to power, we have just finished to agree about the Arusha Agreement. It has been agreed that he will follow to implement this Arusha Agreement. He has done his best.
The surrender of the former Sudanese militia leader boosts hopes that the ICC could try others wanted for crimes in Darfur. Kenya launches a home-based isolation to slow the spread of COVID-19. Zambian Roman Catholic bishops call for the withdrawal of a constitutional amendment bill. And it appears there is a stalemate over the date for Malawi's court-mandated presidential election.
The bill did not pass with the needed two-thirds majority of the vote. So as we speak, the bill from the government has been shot down because they wanted parliament to amend some of the sections of the constitution.
Maurice Mutale is the national publicity secretary for the opposition Malawi Congress Party. And Zimbabwe seeks to amend its constitution to give more powers to the president. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The sudden death of outgoing Burundian President Pierre Nkurunziza on Tuesday came as a shock to everyone on the African political scene. Nkurunziza ruled Burundi with an iron fist for 15 years, including a controversial third term that saw hundreds killed in protests and more than half a million fleeing the country. Some expect nothing will change in terms of how Burundi handles its governance issues. Mohamed Yusuf reports.
Burundi has begun 7 days of mourning after the death of President Pierre Nkurunziza, who died Monday at a hospital in the town of Karuzi. The government said Nkurunziza died from cardiac arrest, but there is speculation the cause may have been COVID-19, the disease caused by the coronavirus. Local media reported the late president's wife was flown to a Nairobi hospital last week after contracting the virus. Nkurunziza was due to step down in August and hand power to the winner of last month's election, retired Army General Evariste Ndayishimiye. Domitien Ndayizeye handed power to Nkurunziza in 2005 at the end of Burundi's civil war. He says the main task given to Nkurunziza was to implement a political agreement between the Hutu majority and Tutsi minority.
When it comes to power, we have just finished to agree about the Arusha Agreement. It has been agreed that he will follow to implement this Arusha Agreement. He has done his best. Maybe there has been some issues on which he has not been able to reach, and I think the next president will go on.
The agreement signed in Tanzania ended a civil war that claimed the lives of more than 300,000 people. Some opposition politicians accused the late president of violating the constitution when he ran for a third term in 2015. His government was also accused of unleashing the ruling party youth wing, known as Imbonerakure, on its opponents. Lewis Marge is a Burundi researcher with Human Rights Watch.
Most of my time I was documenting abuse committed by the Imbonerakure, which were the youth militia aligned with the ruling CNDD-FDD party. And many of these crimes were happening sort of almost hidden, if you will. But really what we're seeing post-2015 is Nkurunziza giving the green light for these Imbonerakure, these youth militias. We see them really become used as the enforcers across the country. The rise of the Imbonerakure will be Nkurunziza's defining characteristic of his human rights record.
In 2017, Burundi became the first country to withdraw from the International Criminal Court after being accused of committing crimes against humanity. Burundi also closed offices of the United Nations on Human Rights and, in May, expelled officials from the World Health Organization. Last week, four journalists were imprisoned to terms of 2.5 years for investigating political unrest in the west of the country. Marge says the human rights situation may not improve with the passing of Nkurunziza.
I don't think we're going to see much change with the death of Nkurunziza with regards to human rights standards. It went beyond just one individual. So I think we're unfortunately looking at dark days ahead.
Naleke van der Waal, Deputy Director for Central Africa at the International Crisis Group, says the future of Burundi depends on what the political system left behind by Nkurunziza will do in the coming months.
He was expected to remain influential because he was appointed Supreme Guide of Patriotism. So it was likely that he continued to play a role on the political scene in Burundi. So with his death, it is possible that Evariste has more freedom of movement to act more independently. But then again, Nkurunziza is only one man, and his rule was underpinned by a political system. And that system is still very much in place.
For now, the Speaker of Parliament will be in charge of the affairs of the state until the President-elect is sworn in on August 20th. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
The surrender this week of former Sudanese warlord Ali Kushai to the International Criminal Court has raised hopes that others wanted for crimes in Sudan's Darfur region could be turned over to the ICC, including former Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir. Sudanese officials in February said that former officials, including Bashir, would face trial at the ICC. Naba Muhyiddin has reaction from Khartoum.
Ali Kushaib is in the custody of the International Criminal Court, ICC. After surrendering to authorities in the Central African Republic on Tuesday, Kushaib was a commander of a militia, the Popular Defense Forces, also known as the Janjaweed, that attacked towns and villages in Darfur as the government of then-President Omar al-Bashir tried to crush a rebellion that began in 2003. The ex-warlord is now facing charges of war crimes and crimes against humanity, including counts of murder, torture, pillaging and rape. Kushaib's surrender has raised hope that others wanted for crimes in Darfur could be turned over to the International Criminal Court. Salmi al-Hashimi was a defense lawyer for protesters arrested during demonstrations against former President Bashir. She says Kushaib's arrest puts pressure on the current Sudanese government. Salmi says the transitional government earlier stated that it doesn't mind forming a hybrid court to sue the accused people of crimes in Darfur. But since the statement was issued, no serious steps or procedures were taken. The arrest of one of the accused people and the delivery of him to ICC hands in The Hague shall put an end to the lack of progress on this case. Kushaib is one of six men wanted by the ICC for crimes in Darfur. The list of suspects includes Bashir, who was ousted by the military last year after months of protest against his 30-year iron fisted rule. The ICC issued an arrest warrant for Bashir in 2008, accusing him of war crimes, genocide, and crimes against humanity. A Sudanese court sentenced him to 2 years in detention for corruption last December. There are reports in the Sudanese media that Kushaib may be used as a witness against other war crime suspects. Political analyst Ahmed Abdel Ghani thinks that would cause trouble for the transitional government. Abdel Ghani says if Kushaib is used as a witness for the state regarding war crimes in Darfur, it will lead to political complications, especially that some military institutions might be involved in the conflict with Kushaib and other militias in committing war crimes and genocides in Darfur region. That step will definitely add confusion to the Sudanese political scene. The Darfur conflict killed more than 300,000 people and has left 2 million internally displaced. In a statement, ICC Chief Prosecutor Fatou Binsouda said Kushaib's surrender is a milestone in the court's dealings with the Darfur situation. She called on Sudanese authorities to ensure tangible justice for the victims in Darfur without delay and said ending impunity for atrocities is essential to achieving durable peace and security in Darfur. Naba Muhyiddin for VUA News, Khartoum.
The Kenyan Ministry of Health has launched home-based isolation that would allow COVID-19 patients to recover from home under government guidelines. Health Chief Administrative Secretary Rashid Aman said the move was taken to decongest health centers that are crowded with symptomatic patients. As Maureen Ojiambo reports from Nairobi, Kenya has so far recorded 3,094 positive cases and 89 deaths.
The Ministry of Health in Kenya has come up with guidelines that will see COVID-19 patients who are asymptomatic go through home-based isolation as a way of decongesting the hospitals. Speaking in Nairobi, Kenya's Health Chief Administrative Secretary Rashid Aman said that 78% of COVID-19 positive cases in hospitals are asymptomatic and can be managed at home. Aman said the patients will be monitored and health services given if need arises.
78% of infected persons, that is, admitted in our hospitals, are either asymptomatic or mildly symptomatic and therefore can be managed at home. The home-based isolation and care guidelines dictates these procedures. Eligibility, care procedures, medical monitoring, referral system to health facilities when the need arises.
The World Health Organization, WHO, recommends that all laboratory-confirmed cases should be handled in healthcare facilities. However, in cases where isolation is not possible in hospitals, home-based care can be recommended, especially for patients with mild symptoms. Mr. Mann said that those who live in informal settlement will receive health care services in community institutions that the ministry will recommend as suitable for the care.
Home-based care in informal settlements where households share small spaces will require identification of institutions within the community, institutions that meet the recommendations for providing such care. To succeed, Ministry of Health appeals to non-governmental organizations, for they are very much involved and work at the community level, to partner with us in this fight against COVID-19. Implementation of these guidelines begins immediately.
Yesterday, Wednesday, Kenya recorded 105 COVID-19 positive cases, bringing the total tally to 3,094. Mr. Mann said most of the cases recorded are from truck drivers at the border points.
When the issue of truck drivers at the various border points, particularly the border points with the Uganda border at Busia, have remained of great concern to us. And as a ministry, we are working very closely with the county government of Busia to provide them with the support that they may need for us to jointly address the situation there.
Health Ministry has earlier blamed Kenyans of not following government instructions in fight against COVID-19 and the risk they are undertaking on home-based care may increase the number of infections in the country as some patients may defy home-based care guidelines. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Nairobi, Kenya.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, June 11th. It seems there is more confusion about when Malawi's court-mandated fresh presidential election will be held. The parliament failed on Wednesday to garner a two-thirds majority to agree to June 23rd as the date for the election. A motion introduced by opposition parliamentarians to have the election on June 23rd passed on Tuesday. On Wednesday, members of the ruling Democratic Progressive Party, the DPP, reintroduced the motion in the form of a bill, but it failed because it did not get the two-thirds majority as required. It appears the courts may have to intervene to clarify. Maurice Mutale is the National Publicity Secretary for the main opposition Malawi Congress Party. He says, as far as the opposition is concerned, June 23rd is the date for the court-mandated fresh election.
On Tuesday, what happened was a motion was passed on the date of election, and the date, as we speak, is 23rd June. But what the government wanted was that the elections must not be done through a motion. Rather, they wanted it to come as a bill, and when the bill was passed, they wanted it to be signed by the president and then have the constitutional sections amended so that the elections, according to them, are constitutional in nature. But what did not happen was that the bill did not pass with the needed two-thirds majority of the vote. So as we speak, the bill from the government has been shot down because they wanted Parliament to amend some of the sections of the Constitution. So what happened today, in brief, is that there is no bill that passed in Parliament in regard to the date of election. Rather, Parliament agreed on the date yesterday through a motion in Parliament.
Is it likely that, the ruling party could challenge this in court?
Looking at the time that we have, if the government chooses to begin some legal litigations, then we are going to delay the whole thing. The Parliament passed a motion, and that motion was about the date of election. And it is the same House that said, yes, we can go for that date. As to the other issues, that relate to either the constitution or the logistics, then those things can be sorted out either before the elections or even after, because we are looking at something that must be done rather than having to be hindered by some technicalities.
It doesn't seem to me that there's much time left because June 23rd is around the corner. Does the Malawi Congress Party hope to also seek clarification from the court?
The courts already said that the parliament should set a date for the election. That is what the ruling was all about from the Constitutional Court and the Supreme Court of Appeal. They asked parliament to set a date, and the parliament has set a date through a motion. And a motion is one of the procedures that the parliament uses or goes through to reach a resolution. And a resolution by the majority of members of parliament was reached at yesterday through a motion. So Malawi Congress Party is never going to seek any clarification because we already have a ruling that clarified everything else. The only remaining thing was that parliament should set a date. So why should we go back to court as if we don't understand the ruling itself? We understand the ruling, and the one thing that parliament had to do was only to set a date, and that parliament has done. No need for us to seek any clarification. I just want to say one thing. There is nothing that is going to stop Malawians from changing the way things are run in this country. There is nothing that is going to stop the people's passion, the people's anxiety, the people's wish that we go to the polls. And anything that the government is going to do to derail this and to frustrate this process is going to add anger.
Maurice Mutale is the National Publicity Secretary for the main opposition Malawi Congress Party. He was speaking with us from the capital, Lilongwe. The Zambian Catholic Bishops' Conference is calling for the withdrawal of the Constitutional Amendment Bill 2019, also known as Bill Number 10. Among other provisions, the amendment seeks to revise the preamble to reaffirm the Christian character of Zambia, the electoral system for elections to the National Assembly. It also seeks to revise the period for the dissolution of the National Assembly and the period of hearing and determination of a presidential election petition. It also revises the functions of the Bank of Zambia. Father Cleophas Longu is the Secretary General of the Zambia Conference of Catholic Bishops. He says the bill should be immediately withdrawn because some provisions seek to divide Zambians.
In the bill, we have seen radical suggestions for substantial and wholesale revision of the Constitution. We believe that that is going beyond the original intention of the bill. Secondly, in terms of the process of coming up with the bill, the Catholic bishops in Zambia have noticed and observed that there wasn't a sufficient and extensive consultation with the people of Zambia, who are the authors and the owners of the Constitution.
The bishops cite provisions in the bill, say, for example, deputy ministers, changes in the electoral system regarding mayors, council chairpersons, members of parliament, and the president. What are the concerns of the bishops with these provisions?
The Catholic bishops in Zambia have noted that there are in there a number of clauses that are innocent, some which can be described to be progressive. However, all the retrogressive and innocent clauses are overcrowded by those provisions that are highly contentious, some which are questionable, and some where there is no consensus at all in terms of the people of Zambia agreeing on how they want to be governed. A question of reintroducing deputy ministers, for example. We believe that Zambia is not a rich country, so as to have a bloated cabinet. We believe that we are now struggling to have enough resources to go into social sectors like education, the provision of high-quality health services to our people, simply because we are overly indebted.
You say that the bill is divisive. How is it divisive?
The Zambia Conference of Catholic Bishops is alive to the fact that Zambia emerged from the last general elections in 2016 as a highly polarized and divided country. You can almost say in a pictorial form, there is a green half of the country and the red half of the country. Just as in the States, you can talk of red and blue. But this bill, Bill 10 of 2019, has added to the process of polarizing the Zambian community or society that is already highly polarized and divided. We bemoan the fact that people are taking partisan positions. They are not thinking of the country, but they are thinking of their political party position. This is not good for the country. A constitution should not be a political document that encapsulates only the views of one half of the country. It must encapsulate the views and aspirations, the desires and the hopes, as well as the anxieties of all Zambians. We believe in the Catholic Church, a constitution-making process must be able to galvanize the entire country to think not of a political party, not of a region, not of a tribe, but think of a national cause, unity of purpose.
Father Cleophas Longu is the Secretary General of the Zambia Conference of Catholic Bishops. He was speaking with us from the capital, Lusaka. Zimbabwe's government is frantically trying to amend the constitution to give the president more powers, with cabinet already approving the proposed amendment. The bill is in the hands of parliament, which will start public consultation soon. Reporter Kuzai Navashe has details.
The move to amend the constitution is happening amid subdued activity while the country remains in a partial lockdown. Parliament recently released a schedule of public hearings on the amendment. Political analyst Rashid Mukundu says this is very telling.
The decision by the Parliament of Zimbabwe to prioritize public consultations on the constitutional amendment clearly showed the selective approach to policy issues and governance matters in Zimbabwe, because the constitutional amendments are not an urgent matter.
The amendment would give the president the sole mandate to appoint High Court and Supreme Court judges, among many other powers. Tawanda Chimini, with the Election Resource Center, questions the urgency of the bill.
What's the hurry? There is nothing that can be deemed extremely urgent for the country. From our own assessment, the bill basically seems hell-bent on consolidating power in the executive more than anything. When you look at almost 20 out of the 28 proposed changes, you can't ignore the fact that there is real potential that this bill is about the 2023 election. It's about consolidation of power and preparation for the 2023 election.
Chimini says Zimbabwe's election disputes have often been resolved in the courts, hence the focus on consolidating power there.
If the executive assumes greater powers around appointment of judges, an election dispute is considered and finalized. Look at all our elections over the last 2-3 cycles. You realize that all our elections have literally been determined by the courts, particularly the presidential level.
He adds that the electoral dispute resolution mechanism will be compromised if this bill sails through. The proposal has been widely rejected by civil society and the Political Actors Dialogue, or POLAD, which the president and his ruling party are part of.
This is being stampeded at a time when there is a lockdown. A lockdown means ordinary Zimbabweans can't travel to public hearings to be heard on this. A constitutional amendment, in my view, is too important to be rushed.
Munyaradzi Dodo, editor of Open Parley, an online publication that covers parliament and other political developments, says pre-lockdown public hearings were not receiving much attendance and fewer will be expected for the proposed amendment, pushing a rubber stamp process. He adds that this amendment means nothing to ordinary Zimbabweans worried about bread and butter issues. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinawashe from Harare.
And that's it for this Thursday, June 11th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing you a very good day.